This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everybody. There's the buzzer, and we are off. This is Pete Caliendo, and you are listening to and watching Baseball Outside the Box, the show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds. We love the challenge of status quo. I want to thank everybody in the U.S. and around the world for joining us. We really appreciate it. We'll be with you in a minute. We want to just introduce, this is going to be a great show. This is a great show, not just for baseball people, but I think people in general, to learn a lot about what's going on nowadays and how to handle yourself, how to prepare yourself the best. We've got a guy that, unbelievable, 81,000 followers on Twitter. He's well known in the U.S. and around the world, not only because of baseball, but he's worked with Olympic athletes. He is the director of player and health performance for the New York Yankees, owner of Cressy Sports Performance. I don't even have to introduce him, really, because he's guest speaker all over the world. He's spoken at the ABCA. He's worked with gold medal teams. He was at Team USA. So let's not even waste any time, because we only got so much time with him. Let's get rocking and rolling. Welcome Eric Cressy to the show. How you doing, Eric?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
And like I said, thank you for being part of the show, because, you know, you don't know me from Adam, but yet, you know, you just love helping people in the baseball world. And we really appreciate you joining the show. So let's do this. Let's just get started. The number, I'll give you an example. I got a question right before I joined the show from some of the coaches, and we'll let some of them in, some more coming in. It was a coach that had an 11-year-old son. I think this makes a lot of sense. He says, you know, he's been in the house for 2 months now. He's been trying to do as much as possible. You know, that he's getting bored. I can't keep his attention. I can't keep him motivated. He's really looking for that help. And I could certainly understand that, because I think, you know, you've got a place, you're in the East Coast, but you got a place in Florida also. I'm in Chicago. You know, it's finally starting to get warm, but I've been in for 2 months also, and you can get a little crazy.
No doubt. Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I'm at our Jupiter facility, or I'm in Jupiter, Florida, I should say.
Oh, nice.
Massachusetts has been locked down pretty crazily, whereas Florida started to open up a little bit. So we've at least got fresh air. But I can absolutely relate with being having impatient, cooped up kids in the house, because I have 25-year-old daughters and a 15-month-old daughter as well. So I'm quarantined here in the guest bedroom for this podcast, escaping the loud, crazy kids outside the door.
So tell me, to that dad, what would you say to him? What's he going to do with that 11-year-old that when he's cramped up in the house he's been doing? I'm not sure exactly what he's doing, but, you know, I know your advice would help go a long ways to kind of help him out.
Yeah. One of the things I always say when you're dealing with young athletes, right? And, you know, for me, it's kind of below 13. You always have to have option A, but you also need to have option B, C, D, and E. And what we know is, you know, look at little kids, you know, take a little kid, like a 6 or 7 year old, when he walks into an amusement park and his head's just on a swivel, looking around at all the amazing things. We know that kids crave variety. They crave novelty. They want these really rich proprioceptive experiences. And it's interesting, if you ask my, you know, 5 year olds to try something, they're gung ho. They'll go and do it. They'll recklessly run into a wall, whatever it takes. They don't think twice about it. As, you know, as kids get older, they get a little more reserved. They're not as willing to necessarily try new things as they get, you know, into different social situations. So I always say you need to leverage that. And so if you have an 11-year-old that's cooped up in the house, really, it just needs to be the kind of thing where you have a bunch of different options to try it out. I bought our daughters the game Twister, you know, when we got started on. So we have kind of some functional mobility training going on with that. And it keeps them engaged, because they don't have phys ed class at school. Some days we ride bikes. Some days we're, you know, playing Frisbee in the backyard, whatever it is. But I can tell you that this is actually a really beneficial time for skill acquisition. In the 3 months that this has been going on, my daughters have learned how to swim, and they've learned to ride bikes with no training wheels. And it's just because we've had more time to practice those things. And, you know, certainly there are other parts of their lives, i.e., you know, lots of time in a classroom, that have gotten pushed out while we homeschool. But I do think there's something to be said about giving kids variety at this time. So the reason your kid may be bored or, you know, going crazy is that you're probably asking to do the same things over and over again. So maybe it's, you know, the kind of thing where at that age, you just need to give them a broader exposure and a number of different things.
Absolutely. Sounds like running a baseball practice.
It's right. It.
Yeah, yep. Not running the same one all the time, doing different drills, like you said, mixing it up, using different weights or whatever it may be.
Competition, you know, too. Like, that's the other thing that those kids are missing. Like, I think back to my Little League days, and the thing that I stand that stands out above all else was the grounder game, right? They lined all the kids up around the edge of the infield at the end of it. And basically, you know, when you booted a ground ball, you were out. And, you know, it was a big deal to win the grounder game because you got a free soda or ice cream or something like that. So competition is big, even at age 11. So find ways to instill that as best you can.
Absolutely. Well said. You know, at the same point, I'm going to stick with the young kids just at the beginning, kind of work our way up a little bit. You know, with the young kids, when we talk about development, you hear a lot about, you know, in baseball especially, and I know I fell into this because I only played baseball when I was younger, and you lose that athletic development, that athletic movement. Talk a little bit about the importance of, especially that they call it that windows of trainability where they need it at that time. And on top of that, multi-sport athletes. Maybe mix that up a little bit.
Yeah, so there's an old saying. It's actually not that old. It's Mbaye, who's a specialist in the world of youth athletic development. He has a line. He says, "Early to ripen, early to rot." So we want to be careful about peaking in one specific capacity early on. I can't remember what I was doing a podcast just the other night, and I talked about this. But you'd be shocked at how many of our big leaguers were not even like, you know, elite high school performers, right? And by elite, you know, maybe they weren't Division I players, whatever it may be. And now they're Major League Baseball superstars. And, you know, certainly that's getting a lot of attention now with, you know, only having five rounds in the draft or, you know, a lot of those 19th rounders that just figured it out late. I had Lou Trevino from the A's on my podcast, you know, the other day. Lou was, you know, kind of a three-sport athlete out of high school, went to Slippery Rock Division II program. You know, while he was there, he figured out a cutter, which got him drafted. And then it was a couple years into baseball. There was that one just mechanical thing that clicked for him. He learned to be more rotational in his delivery. And now he's 96 to 99 and a, you know, impact player in a major league bullpen. And I think we miss a lot of those guys if we force specialization too early. You know, he was a kid who played, you know, three sports, and, you know, he's one of many, many examples like that. So I'm a big believer in play it as long as you can. I love the fall spring split for athletes. You know, if you can get a, you know, high school football player who wraps up around Thanksgiving, you get time to do a really good throwing program. And, you know, before he goes out and starts the spring baseball season, they just tend to work really, really well. So super important to have that multifaceted experience athletically and to really focus on a number of different skills at a young age to build a broad foundation that you can build those specific skills on over the course of time.
And folks, as we go on, just in the chat section, if you got questions, type them in. We'll do our best to get them in. We really want to get your questions because I think the show is more important for you guys and gals that are joining the show, whether it's live on Facebook or Twitter or Zoom. Go to Eric's podcast, by the way, Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I listened to Colton Wong the other day. Excellent one also. Great shows. I listen to them all the time. So check them out. And we'll email you everything he has as far as the facilities and all the information for Eric. We'll have that email to you after the show. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, you know, you're talking about players as we get a little older, you know, go to high school, college, your professionals, concerns you have because, you know, these guys been inside, a lot of them working out, doing stuff. Now they're going to go outside. Some might only have 2 weeks of spring training. Some may only have a week. We don't know. What's the major concern we should have with them getting out, and how should they prepare for that?
Yeah, it's a huge issue. Actually, I devoted my entire podcast, which actually just went live this morning, to this. So there's a couple things that we can look at. There are a couple places where sports have opened back up already. So the Bundesliga is a German professional soccer division. In their first week of games, their injuries were up 226% compared to normal periods. You know, and some of those, you know, could have been a little bit inflated from a roster manipulation, but we're also seeing a pretty significant trend in the Korean baseball organization as they've opened up. It's actually been a lot of like lower extremity stuff. And I saw something about an oblique and a wrist, but for the most part, we're actually seeing a lot of hamstrings and groins. And if you really think about what's happening, what I've noticed is since the world is kind of closed down, most everybody has been able to continue to throw, you know, whether the guys are thrown into a sock in an apartment in New York City, or whether they've got a plyo care ball and they're doing some weighted ball stuff against the dugout wall. I know guys who are playing catch with their wives. You know, we've been fortunate, you know, in a warm weather climate, and as long as you get a throwing partner, you can get out and air it out. And, you know, we have guys throwing live. We have some pretty unbelievable matchups taking place actually down here in Palm Beach Gardens. But, for the most part, guys are staying on top of throwing. So I don't think we're going to see this surge in Tommy Johns and lat strains and stuff like that, because for the most part, you know, guys have stayed on top of throwing. So I think the bigger thing that we are going to see, though, is guys, you know, in many cases haven't been able to get outside nearly as much. They haven't been able to sprint. They've been working out in backyards and patios. So I do think we actually are going to see a lot more hamstrings and groins and calves, more of these general athletic injuries as opposed to specific ones. And so you haven't necessarily done that. You haven't run the bases. You haven't changed directions in a, you know, in a rundown. You haven't had to get out of the box, you know, after an awkward swing. So I think we're going to see that. I think the other thing we may see a few of is that we may see some oblique strains, because there's going to be some hitters that haven't been fooled in the box, you know, since late February, early March. So I think those are the areas we're probably going to see the most. That's the professional level, though. And that's a really important differentiation. My suspicion is that on the amateur side, the younger levels, we're going to see a crazy epidemic of arm injuries. In fact, I'd be willing to put money on it. And there's going to be a lot of reasons for that. One, I think we saw a lot of athletes that weren't built up in the first place, right? The world kind of shut down before things could get really going. Even down here in Florida, like, they weren't that far into their season. In Massachusetts, the high school baseball season starts the third Monday in March. They didn't even start. So what we're going to see is a lot of kids that get going once June, July wraps runs around, right? So they've got a short season. I think we're going to see a lot of kids that put a lot of pressure on themselves from a scouting or a performance, whatever it is, standpoint. They're going to push too hard too soon. So I fully anticipate that, unfortunately, we're going to see more arm injuries this year unless people are really proactive about doing a gradual on-ramping. You know, I hope if we got high school coaches and players and parents listening here that, you know, those kids have started to play catch and build up their long toss. So that's going to be, I think, a big thing we have to watch out for. The other thing that, you know, is an unfortunate side effect of all this is I think you're going to see that discrepancy between northern and southern players being even more pronounced this year. These southern players, you know, it's going to be even more exaggerated. They've been outside. We have guys, you know, we had catchers that were doing throwdowns to second base today. We had guys taking ground balls. They're hitting the cage. They're hitting live. You know, they're not getting that in the Northeast. You know, and there's somewhat of a political dynamic to that as well. It's just northern, you know, states, some of them are less likely to open up based on what you've seen in New York State, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. They're very, very locked down. Maine, you know, whereas, you know, we've seen states like Georgia and Florida that have opened up sooner. I think we're definitely going to see, you know, southern players kind of dominate even more than they probably already do.
You know, it's interesting, which means, you know, you almost have to divide all these separate areas and treat them differently.
Yeah.
And say, you know, let's take the high school kids, you know, because even Alan Jager says, you know, if you're completely shut down for a couple months and you haven't done anything, it's going to take you at least 6 weeks to ramp up, I believe, to throw. So you almost have to know where they're at and say, okay, ideally, what do we do here? We wait a month and train a month before. I mean, safety comes first, doesn't it? Then we're worrying about playing games.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Safety is you know, absolute highest. And I mean, it's to be honest, even sounds like a little bit of a moot point for us to even be talking about injuries with what's really going on in the world, right? So, you know, with that said, I do think we have to look at everything on a case by case basis. And I agree with Alan. Like, there's an old saying in the industry: for every day that you're shut down, it takes another day to ramp up. So if you know, strain a calf or something like that and you miss 6 weeks, you're probably looking at a 6 week throwing program to get back to where you were. And where this is different than most injuries, most of the time you get an injury and it's, you know, it's a hiccup, you're off 7 to 10 days and you start a gradual throwing program. We have scenarios where guys have just stopped throwing altogether. Mm-hmm. They've lost everything. So I don't think it's as long of an on-ramp as we would expect at the end of, you know, their off-season shutdown period to when they gradually ramp up. But, you know, if you look at professional baseball, for the most part, there are a few guys that are still like starting to play catch when January rolls around. Usually they're the guys that are, you know, pitching into the World Series. They have a really long season. For the most part, though, you don't see a lot of guys that are, you know, waiting around, you know, past December 1st or something like that. In general, big leaguers and guys of all levels seem to be playing catch earlier now than they ever have before. So I just think we're going to see a lot of kids that try to do it too fast, and it's unfortunately going to be too late.
Eric, I realize that strength isn't the only thing when it comes to pitching or throwing. You know, there's the body. There's a lot of different things, you know, like you said, the long toss, the workout, the throwing. But as far as trying to reduce the injury from a strength standpoint, what should players be working on indoors, or if they can get indoors or in their basements, to kind of reduce that?
Yeah, I think it's multifactorial. And I'll give you the lowest hanging fruit first. Get in your cleats. That sounds like the stupidest suggestion ever, but no one's been wearing cleats since this shutdown.
Yeah.
And We know the first week of spring training is brutal because there are a bunch of guys that haven't worn their cleats enough in the off season, and then they go and they stand in them for 6 days. So with the lowest hanging fruit is have guys, even if you just go out in the backyard and walk around in cleats, put them on, get readjusted to it, because they are different than trainers. We're going to save ourselves some Achilles, some plantar fascia stuff, you know, some anterior knee pain, just because guys are more adjusted to it. So that's a first thing. The second thing I would say is, you know, you need to check in with all your players to make sure that they actually are throwing. Because if you're expecting them to, you know, pitch in a tournament, you know, right after the 4th of July or something like that, and here we are, it's May 27th while we're recording this, like, they can start now and probably be ready in time. Maybe they're not at their best, but they're built up enough. If they wait, you know, until June 20th, it's kind of like flossing on the way to the dentist. It's not a really good strategy. So they need to start throwing. And then the third thing I would say is they need to get out. They need to sprint. They need to change direction. Even if it's not 100%, you've got to gradually start getting readjusted to those ground reaction forces. And sprinting is the thing, I just anecdotally, it's the one that guys are probably going to miss during this downtime. Everybody can figure out a way to do some, you know, grab a backpack and do some goblet squats at the house. Nobody's really going out and pushing sprinting unless they really have, you know, a big backyard or facilities that are convenient to them. So I've really stayed on our guys a lot. Like, we got to run, you know, not run like 3 miles, but we got to, you know, go out and do some sprints, some agility work, some plyos. Those are important. And, you know, it goes without saying that if we're talking about young athletes, like, strength conditioning is a huge priority, right? If you're not strong, you need to get strong. It's going to, you know, build a higher level of resiliency and protect you against injuries. So, you know, certainly do what you can at the house with what you've gotten, or, you know, if, you know, facilities are starting to open up wherever you are, take advantage of that safely as well.
And you mentioned that some of the injuries you're worried about, especially at the older levels, are there's, you know, the leg issues and the obliques. So they need to concentrate on certain things there to make sure that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, you have to look at path of least resistance too, right? We very rarely see, you know, like a 9-year-old go out and tear an ACL, right? But they have growth plate injuries all the time. They break bones and they fall out of trees. That's because the bone is the path of least resistance. When we get older, you know, basically those bones become more skeletally mature. And as a result, we start tearing ligaments and leg and tendons and muscles and things like that more often. So it just speaks to, you know, we got to make sure that we build that higher level of strength and resiliency against those issues. But I do think we'll see more overuse injuries in players that just, they're going to show up unprepared. And, you know, and it's hard to fault them with the way the world is right now. It's, you know, there's very much of a mindset in many places of don't do anything, don't go outside, all of that.
Absolutely. Before we get into some of the stuff you're doing with the Yankees on the player development and health and performance, I want to ask this part because, you know, this question comes up all the time, so we might as well get it out and make sure of this. One, you know, kids weightlifting. When do you start? What do you use? Sure. Resistance, bands, whatever. Just kind of a guideline there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I would tell you is the research is actually very compelling that, you know, this whole idea of resistance training stunting growth is really not correct. Dr. Avery Fagenbaum at the College of New Jersey has published some wonderful research in that regard. You can definitely check it out. There's tons of free, you know, full text articles out there. Here's what we know is your collarbone does not become skeletally mature until you're about 25 years old. So no one runs into every high school football weight room and says, don't bench press. You're going to stunt your clavicle growth, right? That doesn't happen. They certainly don't do it in college weight rooms either. So that's the first thing I'm going to tell you is that, you know, that's an important consideration. The second thing is just think about the craziness of young kids, right? I'm blown away at my daughters. Like, every day I think they should have concussions and ACL injuries and all this, like, the way they contort their bodies and get in crazy positions as they wrestle with each other and all this stuff. Kids are actually remarkably resilient. What's the most interesting is when you go out and sprint, you put between 6 and 8 times body weight in ground reaction forces in single leg stance. That's a really big deal. You're talking about, you know, a minimum of 900 pounds in ground reaction forces. Wow. For a 150 pound kid going out there and doing sprints. But nobody contraindicates that. Nobody contraindicates, you know, carrying a heavy backpack full of books on the way to school. Nobody contraindicates jumping out of trees. Those are all forces in very chaotic environments. What we can do in a good resistance training setup is we can gradually expose them to those forces in biomechanically correct patterns. And we have a lot of research that shows that if we get enough quality reps in, you know, with those exercises, it does actually carry over to functional things where we want to, you know, distribute forces correctly across multiple joints, whether that's, you know, a change of direction, a baseball swing, you know, throwing a baseball, whatever it may be, you know, good training in the weight room or wherever it is you do it will carry over to on-field performance. And, you know, the patterns that you train will be optimized, you know, across multiple disciplines. So I don't get worried at all about kids' resistance training. I think the most important thing is similar discussion earlier is you have multiple options for them. You give them a lot of variety. The loading is appropriate. Sometimes it's just body weight. Sometimes it's bands. You know, like you can get a lot out of teaching a kid how to do a good lunge, you know, pull up, push up with correct technique, understanding how to just use like their bands correctly for their arm care exercises. That's some really low hanging fruit that gets, you know, overlooked for sure. So I have no concerns in the context of our facility. I've seen everything across the board. We have a kid who trains with us right now. He's a rock star. He's 12 years old, like picture perfect technique on everything. And he loves it. Like he's 3 days a week. He and his dad do it together. Like he is all in. He's got a CSP shirt that he wears for like every day of the week. And I love it. And I would never force a kid to do that much, but he's like all in on it. And it's great. And I'm totally fine with that. Cause to me, it's no different than a kid wanting to go to the cage or go out in the backyard and play catch with his dad or something like that. But I would never force it on a kid that's not ready at that age. So the one thing I would say though is, I would much rather get an untrained 13 or 14 year old than I would to get a 16 or 17 year old who's just done stupid stuff in the basement for 3 years. You'd rather have that blank slate where you don't have to unlearn bad patterns as opposed to the kid who's done some stupid stuff on his own and basically made your job a little bit harder.
What's the balance when you're talking about 12, 13, 14 year olds with the strength and the actual skills?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is the deciding factor is usually what's up here, right? Some of the kids are, you know, certainly a little bit more, I guess, bought in. You want those kids that are locked in because you can't force it at that age. And it has to be their idea, not the parents. But, you know, what's the balance between strength conditioning and skill work? I think it changes throughout the year, right? You're going to have times when you want to get a baseball out of a kid's hand to give them a little time to recharge. And, you know, there's the times when it's better to push harder for, you know, a little bit more of a presence in the weight room or, you know, doing more outdoor conditioning, whatever it may be. Whereas, you know, you get in season, all of a sudden kids are playing 4 or 5 games a week and, you know, maybe you scale it back to one lift, you know, during that time. But I do remember my good friend, Mike Boyle. Mike won a World Series with the Red Sox in 2013. And he's really actually better known for his work in hockey players. And Mike's daughter, Michaela, is a heck of a hockey player. She won a national championship as a freshman. And Mike talked a lot about one of the things that he thinks he did really well with her is from 11 on, so age 11 until the time she left for college, he averaged 2 strength training sessions per week for her. So if you do the math on that, right, you're talking about it, you know, at 11, 2 might be all you do. You know, when she gets to be 17, 18, maybe you're getting in 4 a week and you're pushing it really hard as you get ready for college. So they kind of balance themselves out. But what's also interesting is you kind of go in season and off season. So there may be times when there were, you know, 3 hockey games in a week and she was dragging and she didn't get any in or she got 1 in. But there's kind of like this hills and valleys where over the course of the year, you know, you're basically getting that 104 sessions and 104 over the course of 7-8 years. That's a big deal. You get in 800 or 900 lifts more than your competition. That's a huge competitive advantage. The biggest mistake that I see in a long-term athletic development model in terms of what we do is they go like gangbusters for 3 months in the off season that you don't see them for 9 months. They come back and they're basically just as weak as when they started, but now they're 5 inches taller. So all of a sudden they've got this whole different collection of challenges because their center of mass has moved further up from their base of support. So just being consistent, not selling out for crazy, you know, weight training or anything like that, in terms of like the amount of loading used, you're going to set yourself up for long-term success. So kind of just have to slow cook them.
When you see the game today, the direction it's heading, you know, you see it at all levels because you got guys that come train for you at all levels. I guess, you know, not to be negative, but, you know, to understand the difficulties here, the direction we're heading, can we be going in a different direction? And what would that be if Eric Cressy had your control of it all?
Yeah, the magic wand. You know, there's certain things that I think are definitely challenging about the progressions. You know, I'll say this. I'll talk about the good first just because I'm the eternal optimist, right?
Absolutely.
Probably 5 years ago, people asked me, like, where do you see strength and conditioning, et cetera, in baseball going? And I said it's going to get much more specialized. We already saw it, right? We saw high-paid college football strength coaches and things like that. And, you know, with baseball, you have the single fastest motion in all of sports. Right. You have unique demands, how far the arm lays back, crazy changes of direction. You have crazy hip shoulder separation. You have a very stop and go nature of the sport where you might stand around for 45 minutes and then have to run full tilt. There's a lot of challenges there, right? And that it's the kind of thing that doesn't just lend itself very well to anybody being able to pick up really quickly. So, you know, 2007, when we opened up, we were kind of the only players in the game. We kind of created this baseball strength and conditioning industry just because we saw a need for it. This was a really underserved population. We thought we had some unique skills that could really help them, and we wanted to hone in on it and really develop it and learn as much as we could. So we did that. Now I probably have 20 to 25 former interns who own facilities around the country doing baseball strength and conditioning. Nowadays, you can go to any Division I program, and you know, Brett Price is one of our former interns who's the baseball only strength coach at the University of Alabama. He was at Auburn before that. So we have, you know, people who are kind of doing that at a bunch of different universities around the country. So baseball strength conditioning has gotten more specialized. So I love that because the players are getting the resources they need, or they're getting better resources, right? It's not just the, hey, you got the one strength coach who's got six different teams, barely has time to see you, and you got the grad assistant athletic trainer who's never seen a baseball player in their life. Nowadays, we're actually getting pretty good attention to detail. Not only that, you're seeing a lot of those college programs getting access to some outstanding analytics stuff. If you look at, you know, what Matt Hobbs has at Arkansas, or what the crew at Wake Forest has done with their biomechanics lab, you look at Jackson, Alabama, you got some really smart guys that are doing some cool stuff. So I think that part of the baseball world is amazing. We're heading in a really good direction where, you know, a lot of the stuff we see in the college setting is catching up to pro baseball. And that's why you're seeing pro baseball now going to the private sector, going to the college realm to pluck so many employees. So I think that's great. I think, you know, the continued challenge, to be honest, tends to be, this sounds terrible to say, some kids are too good too soon. If you went back in 07 to 10, we kind of first got going at our facility. If you were an 88 to 90 high school arm, like, you were really good. You were a state player of the year. You were carving people up. And nowadays, even in Massachusetts, you've got 18 to 20 guys that are throwing harder than that each year. You have guys in Massachusetts that are touching 93 that aren't even getting drafted. And so what we've seen is a lot of scaly, immature athletes who are throwing really hard, really soon. That's a good thing because the caliber of play has gone up, and, you know, it's put a lot of these kids on the map earlier. But the problem is, what we're realizing is a lot of these kids are broken and they don't even realize it. So when you go to look at an elbow of a 24-year-old that has Tommy John, you ask Dr. Andrews, you ask Dr. Alchek and Dr. Meister and these big names that are doing these surgeries on pro guys, when these guys go in and get their UCL repair done, there's areas of previous calcification on the ligament, where all these guys had these low-grade injuries when they were younger that they never perceived. And no matter how perfect they did things, eventually, even if they moved well, optimized their mechanics, and continued to throw harder, it was just a structural deficit that was bound to go. And to some degree, pro baseball doesn't worry so much about Tommy Johns like they used to, but we are effectively coming to the realization that, particularly with respect to elbows, there's no such thing as a normal elbow on MRIs in a high-ranking prospect at age 18 to 20 anymore. If you turn on an All-American game, pretty much every arm in that game, granted they're going out to throw, you know, one inning as hard as they can, they're all 95 plus. That just wasn't the case years ago. So that's the part that scares me, and it's hard. You can't tell a kid, don't train for velocity, because velocity puts you on the map and it makes you a more effective pitcher. I think you have to just be careful about selling out for velocity to the exclusion of many other important qualities. So it's just, you know, it plays into how we scout, how we evaluate kids, how we train them. But that's the stuff that scares me a little bit more, is we are pretty infatuated with velocity above all else. And, you know, I think a lot of people, maybe throw some other important qualities to the wayside as they seek it out.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was reading and I want to get your opinion on this, the UCL. It sounds like those muscles can only maintain so much velocity. There's a peak velocity in them. And then after that, you've got to, what do you do?
Yeah, it's challenging. I mean, what we know is, you know, your ulnar collateral ligament, you know, has a limitation to what it can handle, right? We've done studies of cadavers where they basically go and they look what kind of forces it takes to rupture a UCL. And believe it or not, the forces on the medial elbow are actually higher than that on every throw you make. So the question then becomes, why don't we tear a UCL on every throw? And really the proof is that, you know, basically you also have soft tissue structures that cross your elbow that protect your UCL. So, you know, certainly you need to have strength and resiliency from the muscles in the forearm and the, you know, basically attached to the humerus. But what I think we have to be really, really careful about is that's not the only place we need to be strong, right? We need to have tissue length and strength, but we also need to have optimized shoulder function. We need to have mechanical positions that, that give us the best chance of being successful. So you just have to realize that you're kind of playing with fire every time you throw a baseball at a high level. And, you know, good training helps you to distribute those forces over multiple joints and, you know, and be more successful long-term. So, you know, it's why I, you know, speaking of the point earlier, it's why I think it's so important that we have more specialized people to help care for these baseball players, particularly at the highest level.
You know, speaking of specialized levels, your title with the Yankees, Director of Player Health and Performance Coach. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to get into that because there's some questions here possibly in that area. We're talking about health and performance. We're talking about anywhere from sleep habits to, you know, nutrition, all, the whole package, right?
Yeah, it's so the way that our basically setup is structured, you know, the player health and performance is a scenario that kind of encompasses nutrition and strength and conditioning. We also have a great guy, David Whiteside, is our director of performance science. So he's a little bit more on the sports science, which would encompass a little bit of the, you know, the sleep quality stuff and, you know, recovery modalities and, you know, force plate testing, things along those lines. And then we have Mike Shuck, who's our director of sports medicine, and also one of our assistant athletic trainers. So the three of us kind of head up those departments. So sports medicine, player health and performance, and then sports, performance science, kind of like a three-pronged attack. And we all collaborate together. We communicate with each other every single day. But there's always kind of some crossover between the two. But it encompasses a lot of stuff. And really the biggest goal, I think, for all of us is to make sure that everybody's comfortable speaking in, to everyone else. You know, we want to get rid of the whole concept of like, we never want to hear people say, stay in your lane, right? There's one big lane. We're all working in it. We all bounce ideas off each other. Like I said, we communicate every day and we want to do what's in the best interest of every one of the players. And, you know, one of the things I've realized over the years is one of our differentiating factors in the private sector at CSP was the way that we had a synergistic experience among all of our coaching staff, our manual therapists, our physical therapists, our pitching guys, et cetera. So we try to really make sure that we replicate that as well. And, you know, you probably know Matt Blake is our pitching coach. I was fortunate. Matt was our first pitching coordinator at Cressy Sports Performance. So Matt and I got to work together every day, basically between 2008 and 2015 before he was hired by the Indians. So we have this great working relationship. And what's awesome about Matt is he's a major league pitching coach who's read just about everything on my bookshelf. He's sat in on strength and conditioning, continuing educations. He's gone to seminars where he's surrounded by athletic trainers and physical therapists and he can speak the language and totally belongs in the room. And we've tried to really establish that same kind of just, you want curiosity. You want people who are going to be able to potentially see those connections from departments. And, you know, we never want to have anybody that's not interested in collaborating. And thus far, it's been really, really fruitful.
You know, and speaking about, you know, the game definitely has changed, evolved. We got a good friend, Ryan Harrison, from Slow the Game Down.
Yeah, Ryan's great. Ryan's
on, and, you know, and again, here's another guy. I always say this on every show. There's always guys, and at all levels, not just because Ryan is at a high level, but at all levels, we got guys constantly learning. It's great to see that. You see the vision aspect's important. I mean, there's another part of it. There's so much in this package of development. Yeah. You know, and as a young coach that's coming up, what's your recommendation? Because, you know, you could be a high school coach. You got 30, you know this. You got 30 games. You got 25 practices. What's your recommendation? How kind of even youth coaches to put this together a little bit? Because you can get overwhelmed.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's funny you mentioned the sports vision. My wife is actually an optometrist, so we've talked a lot of sports vision. We interact with the Harrisons in the past, and they're great people. Here's what I'll tell you: is it's very easy to want to race to calculus before you've done algebra. And that's a really slippery slope because there's more information available, right? The internet has made, you know, like if I in 2000, you know, when I was first getting going in the industry, wanted to communicate with a, you know, a higher up, you know, like with the New York Yankees or the Dallas Cowboys or whatever it is, like podcasts like this were not happening. There was no way to do it. Like, you literally had to go to the library and start using the Dewey Decimal System.
Yeah, I remember that.
To reverse engineer it. So I always joke with our interns now, like, you guys have no idea how easy it is that it's all lined up in a curriculum for you, and you can go and fact check all this stuff and go on YouTube and get lost in it. You couldn't easily go down this rabbit hole in the past. But what I think it's also done is it's created a scenario where people don't understand how to ultimately define their educational path in terms of what to focus on early. And what I always tell people is, you know, before you can be a really good specialist, you have to be a good generalist. You have to be exposed to a lot of different philosophies. You have to be exposed to a lot of different disciplines. And it kind of comes back to something I just said. And actually, there's a line from Sam Fold. Sam's a close friend. He's now working in the Phillies front office and working as their player information coordinator. Sam's like, you know what? I think I made this smooth transition from playing to the front office / managerial side of things because I'm curious. I always wanted to know a little bit of what everybody was doing. And I've always been the same. You know, I wanted to learn about nutrition. I wanted to learn about physical therapy. I wanted to learn about manual therapy. You know, I'd go lift with power lifters. I'd do whatever I could to try to be exposed to it. So, you know, the number one thing I would give you for advice is I would say, you know, be exposed to a lot of different philosophies and facets of the industry. And more importantly, seek out opportunities to be the dumbest person in the room. Never be afraid to ask questions. I constantly go out of my way. It's one of the hardest things about owning a facility is that everyone always looks to you for the answers. They look to you to make the challenging decisions. They look to you to educate and all those. And you can quickly kind of be put into a position where you're expected to always have the answers. So you can kind of get out of this learning mode. And that's where the Yankees experience has actually been so tremendous for me is, you know, I get to talk to analysts that blow me away with the things that they look at and the amount of, you know, resources they have at their fingertips, whether it's high-speed camera video, you know, information about a player over the course of time. There's just so many resources at your fingertips. And I also, to be honest, I hire like that now. I want to make sure that the people who work, you know, I don't want to say for me, I want to say they work with me at our facilities are people who will constantly challenge me. Our director of performance in Massachusetts, John O'Neill, like John is a rock star. He challenges me every single day, asks me important questions. Shane Rye, Brian Kaplan, my business partners here in Florida, they push me really hard as well. You got to get around really good people like that. And that's true whether you're coaching a, you know, freshman baseball team or whether you're a major league manager. Like these are things that are really important to seek out.
No, I'm going to paraphrase because some of the questions can be pretty long. And, you know, but the question of now the workloads, you know, let's take your system in the minors. But we know there's probably not going to be a minor league system yet. We don't know. But as far as the major league level, what's the workload going to be like? How's the pitches in the innings? You know, the recovery aspect. How are you going to handle these big league guys and also the minor league guys?
Yeah, I think it's challenging to say. I certainly can't speak for minor league baseball right now, and I can only hope for major league baseball because we don't know what's going to happen there. You know, I do think it will be interesting. You kind of have two inherent dynamics at play, right? You have a larger roster, which would lead to a more specialized game, right? You can go more lefty and lefty, but this year they've changed to the three batter minimum. So that side of things is going to be certainly interesting. I think the other dynamic of playing without fans in the stadium, I think we'll see some of the big velocity guys that aren't necessarily able to tap into that velocity as easier. There's a lot of players who, you know, can't throw hard on backfields. They can't really gas up and show you 95 until there's 40,000 people in the stands. So I do think we'll see some of the well-known pitchers in the games who struggle to find some of their normal velocity. So I think we're feeling out what baseball is going to be. We're still learning, you know, what kind of even staffing resources are going to be available based on, you know, some of the initial proposals and all that side of things. So I think like a lot of you, we're waiting to get a little bit more direction in that regard. And I think the other thing is there's inherently distractions, right? Like in the past, everything was all about keeping people healthy and building high performance. And right now, priority number one is keeping people safe. So, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of different like team dynamics, and, you know, it's not going to be the same kind of culture when players have to space out and stagger their training times. And, you know, we might see a scenario where starting pitchers from other days don't even come to the stadium to avoid head counts being too high. Like there's just so many variables in place. And, you know, I think we're all hoping that some of those things are going to be more meticulously defined over the next couple of weeks. But this is going to be the word that keeps getting thrown around is unprecedented. And that's absolutely for sure.
Absolutely. And Eric, in your profession now, what, like, you take your high school kids. I know here in Illinois, there's going to be Illinois kids going next week to a tournament in Indiana because Indiana's opening up. what's the recommendation for coaches as far as pitching these kids? You know, are you looking at pitch counts? Are you looking at innings? Are you looking at stress? All that stuff. Recommendations there to help our coaches.
Yeah, I'd say the first thing I would tell you is I have a sneaking suspicion that we're going to see a lot of games that are kind of like the show and go mentality. Like if you're trying to minimize exposure, the last thing you're going to do is have each team come out and take infield, outfield, et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing I would tell coaches, make sure you get a good warm-up in. Even if you don't have – you know, the best facilities to do it. Don't just let your kids roll out there and start chucking it, you know, at 200 feet. So that would be the first thing for sure. And the other thing is you have to remember that, you know, if you have a kid, a crew of 25 kids who you haven't necessarily had daily interactions with over the last 3 months, you really have no concept of how prepared they are and you're going out to play games. So, you know, if we look at some of the research on, you know, workload, anytime your acute workload exceeds your chronic workload by kind of like a 1.5 to 1 ratio. So in other words, if you're a kid who's conditioned to go out and throw 50 pitches and you go out and you throw 75 or more, we know your incidence of injury actually goes up 2 to 4 times. Hmm. Whereas if you stay within that kind of 1 to 1 ratio, you know, your injury rate might only be about 4%. So obviously you can't just expect everybody to keep the same pitch count forever. But what you can do is you can gradually test the waters, kind of tickle the dragon's tail to steal a line from my buddy, Stuart McGill. You know, in those situations, maybe it's a 10% increase in volume week to week. But I think on the front end, you have to assume that all of your kids are more detrained than you think, right? So that might mean your starters are going to go out and throw 2 innings and that's going to be it. And they're going to hate you for it. But you know what? Major league pitchers do it when they start spring training and they're okay with it. So I just think you have to be a little bit cognizant of some of that stuff. You have to look at all the other variables too. You know, how are they recovering, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think inherently we do have to be a little bit more cautious, and what it might mean is we mean that we need to, maybe we make up some of this development a little bit on the tail end. Maybe we play a little bit further into August. Maybe we actually give fall ball a little bit more love than we otherwise would have.
Yeah.
Because we just don't know what the world's going to hold over the next couple months. But I can tell you this, the last thing you want to do is, you know, after you've missed an entire spring season, is to go out and get hurt in the first week of the summer season. Like, sometimes it's better to just go out and, you know, get a little bit of work in and live to fight another week.
I've got to believe that we really have to be careful because you're going to have young kids. I see leagues right now starting in some states when you have 11-year-old kids pitching, 13-year-olds. I mean, they're more fragile, obviously, than our older kids. And the second part is the recovery. You know, we all talk about, you know, after you pitch, here's what you got to do. These are the recovery stages. This is going to be even more important now.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, first and foremost is, you know, there's physiological recovery, right? That's hydration, that's nutrition, that's sleep quality. That's the low-hanging fruit that any kid can take more seriously and get better with. And we all know what happens when kids go on the road in tournaments, right? There's 7 of them playing Fortnite in one room until 3 a.m. Not exactly. I don't even know how that's going to work with social distancing and all that stuff. But I guess you can play Fortnite in different rooms now. But, you know, so that's the first thing is taking care of that really low-hanging fruit. You know, beyond that, you know, there's different perspectives, right? You know, in response to a throwing outing, for the most part, players either get tighter or they get looser, right? If you're an athlete that gets substantially tighter, you're a really stiff guy, you know, you're probably gonna need to spend more time on the mobility side of things. That might be, you know, just some stretching exercise, things like that. Maybe it's some positional breathing. Maybe it's some manual therapy. Maybe you hop on a foam roller, stuff along those lines. And then we're also gonna have that crazy loosey-goosey guy that gets actually looser when he goes out and throws. So for that athlete, you know, giving him some low level stabilization stuff and really starting to, you know, just kind of reestablish some of those good motor control patterns can be good too. So I think, you know, we try to individualize as much as we can, but one of the things I like to do with our athletes is just, you know, put in enough work to learn about how they move and give them an individualized warm up. And usually whatever we do to warm them up for a game is also some stuff that's going to be helpful for them to kind of come down from the game. So a lot of times I'll have guys go back and repeat the most important stuff from their warm-up after they go out and play.
Greg asks here, suggestions for trying to replicate innings in regards to workload on a high school college level.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a little bit challenging. You know, and we've actually started talking about this on the pro side with some of our minor league guys. And I'm worried that these guys who have thrown 150 innings, that they don't have a season, we've got to actually track their innings so that we know what their workload is, you know, prior to the start of next season. But, you know, how do we replicate innings? You know, I think for me, classic innings, 15 to 20 pitches. You know, if we're actually throwing sim games, maybe you have a batter stand in, or you even have just one of the dummies in the box. But, you know, for me, in innings, 15 to 20 pitches, you know, obviously 4 to 5 warmups are kind of at the start, at least to get the ball rolling with some gaps in between. So that's what we've been doing a lot of our pro guys right now. But there are guys that, you know, right now, you know, are going like 3 ups. So we do have starters that, you know, wanted to stay built up. Kluber threw a 75 pitch pen last week. You know, he's pretty well gassed after being in the Florida humidity, like all of us were. But he maintained it. Scherzer's been throwing pretty lengthy pens. Like Robert Gisellman is a guy who's probably going to slide into the Mets rotation. Rob threw 3 ups the other day as well. So I think for the most part, our major league starters are guys that have all tried to maintain a little bit of a higher workload, whereas most of our relievers have been, you know, 120 pitch inning or something like that.
Eric, what's your recommendation when it comes to, you know, after a practice, after games? So should players be doing some things after practices and games, or is it just go home and relax?
You know, I think it depends on the scenario. You know, I don't love the idea of, like, I've never understood, like, having a guy go do a band series after he throws 95 pitches. To me, that's, you know, give him some water, give him some food, let him go to sleep, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe do a little bit of light manual therapy or stretching just to make sure he gets his range of motion back. You know, whereas if a guy goes out and throws 20 pitches, it may be a great time to go in and get some work in, just because then you're consolidating the stress so he kind of has a little bit of a chance to try to you know, kind of rebound on the next day. So you're basically having these highs and lows throughout your developmental calendar. So it's a tricky question to answer, but, you know, for the most part, yeah, I have no problem with guys adding a little bit of conditioning stuff on the end of a practice session. You know, you always want to do your skill development stuff before you would do your strength conditioning stuff. So if you practice for an hour and a half and want to throw, you know, 15 or 20 minutes of core and arm care on the end, I see no problem with that.
All right. Let me take Brian. I know Brian Freeze handles baseball and softball. Yes. Injuries at a peak during the start of you see injuries peak during the start of a major league season, spring training. When do you see that basically? And in college and in softball, when do you see most of the injuries start to peak?
You know, it's interesting. We certainly have the major league baseball numbers. There's a really good study from Posner's group that came out several years ago that showed that basically injury rates were sky high in March and April, and they gradually fell off, and then they go off a cliff in September. Now, we have to take that data with a grain of salt for a couple of reasons. The first off is rosters expand in September, so nobody really gets put on the disabled list. You know, it's just the time of year when you see 40 guys in the dugout, right? So players may be hurt, but, you know, there's really no incentive for them to DL them just for the sake of having, you know, roster limits kind of taken care of. So that part of it is a little bit more skewed. Likewise, we probably see a scenario where spring training injuries are going to be a little bit more inflated, because we probably have athletes who were broken at the end of the previous season. They hoped that rest would work, and then they show up and they test it out and they realize that it's still broken, so they need to go get it fixed. With that said, I don't think that accounts for the entire difference. I do think we see a lot of athletes that show up unprepared. To be honest, I couldn't speak to softball. I have not seen a study, you know, presumably because the competitive season of a softball player is relatively short compared to what we see in Major League Baseball players. So I couldn't tell you that. I would tell you the anecdotally, like, yes, they probably are getting hurt more early in the season. You know, I think there was actually a really good study that came out in 2011. I talked about on this in the podcast I just recorded today, but in 2011, there was an NFL lockout. So the players went from, I think, having a 14-week training camp to having something like I think it was down to 17 days. And there were an absurd number of Achilles ruptures that year. excuse me, I think they ruptured 10 in the first 12 days of camp, and then 2 more in the subsequent 17 days. So you had 12 over the course of the first 4 weeks of NFL participation. League average was like 6 to 10 per year prior to that. So what we saw was, when people show up unprepared and sports ramp up too fast for them, bad things happen. So I think it's probably even more pronounced in a sport like baseball, softball, which is very like max effort, then chill out, max effort, then chill out. Whereas, you know, I think there's something to be said about, like, if we're looking at the soccer population, yes, you'll probably see some, but you'll also see a lot of injuries later in a season or later in games when fatigue is a much bigger issue. So I don't know that I have a great comp for the softball world, but that's my assumption of how it would probably be.
All right. From Jay Pecci. Now, Pecci's a pro coach. Matter of fact, my co-host yesterday with Pat Murphy, He says, I've heard you say that hip control is more important than hip range of motion and hitting. What can you tell us about the importance of deceleration in the swing and how to train for that? Do you have any insights into what force plates can tell us about hitting? And I also wanted to ask, I always thought about that. You know, we talk about throwing, you know, and be careful, deceleration muscles and all that. Well, you know, when we hit, I always thought when we're swinging, aren't we doing the same thing? Don't we have to be cautious there?
Yeah, for sure. So there's a few different questions there. So I've got it in front of me too. So I'm gonna hit them one at a time. So the first thing is, you know, hip control versus hip range of motion. I think one of the things that we have to appreciate is this concept of hip shoulder separation, right? It happens in every elite rotational sport athlete. What we know in basically there's a really great presentation from a buddy of mine who's Ben Hansen, who now works for the White Sox, previously was a MOTUS. And Ben actually just put it out on Twitter a while back. And basically the most hip shoulder separation you're actually going to see is in golfers. And why is that the case? Because golfers, the ball doesn't move on them. Like they control the entire pace of the game. Right. And then the next step down is going to be pitchers, right? Pitchers control the pace of the game, but you know what? Like sometimes they have to be a little quicker to the plate because they've got a guy on base, whatever it may be. And then third is going to be hitters. They don't separate nearly as much just because they're responding to what the pitcher throws at them. You don't, you know, hear about a guy having a long swing. Like that's a guy who's probably getting way too much hip shoulder separation. And, you know, by the time he actually gets going, he's already fooled. So with that said, I think we have to be really careful about trying to make somebody something they're not. And you will see athletes who rely heavily on kind of protective tension. They enjoy the feelings of being tight. And that may be who they are. They may be hardwired to be successful in a very limited window. But I think the bigger issue is, you know, when we talk about hip range of motion, it can change for a lot of different reasons, right? It can change because of the alignment of the femur and the pelvis, maybe not being perfect. So if a femur is really, if a pelvis is really tilted forward, it may block the ability to internally rotate. So there's certainly, you know, stuff there we have to consider. Some people will develop bony blocks either on the head of the femur or on the acetabulum, so either on the ball or the socket that could limit their range of motion. So we just have to realize that, you know, some people don't have great hip range of motion for a variety of reasons. And if we try to sell out for getting a lot of range of motion, sometimes we can stretch them right into a bony block and make them worse. Sometimes we can make them so loose that it throws up some of their coordination patterns. And Greg Rose with On Base U and the Titleist Performance Institute always use the analogy of like, the worst thing you can do for a golfer is like go out and stretch them out prior to the first tee. You make them crazy loose and all of a sudden they have no idea how to control themselves. So when in doubt, if you don't know what to do, you're better off adding stability than you are adding range of motion. So with that said, with respect to hitters, what I look at first is how well do they control the range that they have, right? Can they actively control all the hip extension they have? Can they get clean femoral internal rotation without banging off of a bony block? And some of those guys that, you know, hit with the most pop actually use very, very little hip rotation in their swing. They just time it up incredibly well and really understand how to sequence. So that's the first thing I would say. The second one is the importance of deceleration in the swing and how to train for that. And that's a big one. I think in general, hitters get overlooked in this capacity far, far more than pitchers. And deceleration is a multifaceted thing. You need to be able to distribute forces over multiple joints in the swing. And if the best example I can give you is, you guys all remember when Miguel Cabrera ruptured his biceps tendon swinging? Mm-hmm. Right, that was on a finish. So what basically happened was, I don't even remember what the pitch was. I believe he got fooled on a changeup. He swung, so lead shoulder goes into thoracic rotation, and basically the arm gets to a position here where you can generate anterior instability as the arm continues to go. You can get into elbow hyperextension, and so in his case, he probably went to elbow hyperextension. The biceps tendon got transiently overstretched and it retracted. One of the things that we look for is, how do we take that stress and share it over multiple joints? Well, we make sure he's got adequate thoracic rotation. We make sure he's got plenty of strength and rotator cuff timing to basically control the shoulder girdle to effectively give him a longer arc over which to decelerate. But what I can tell you is lead shoulders and hitters is a big issue. Most of them do have some kind of posterior labral issue. If you look at a right-handed thrower who hits left-handed, mm-hmm. they tend to have pretty ugly right shoulders because they have the adaptations to throwing, but they also have what we would call kind of like a minor batter's shoulder. This tends to be challenging when they get fooled on pitches, right? So the torso keeps going and the humerus, the upper arm lags behind and is kind of late. So what you know, for the nerds out there, you would be hitting the ball in a more horizontally adducted position. Those are certainly bad positions to be in. Tends to happen a lot when guys get fooled, they swing and they miss. So we actually do a ton of arm care stuff for our position players. A lot of the same stuff, honestly, that we do with our pitchers. And it's a really, really big issue. But I think you'd be surprised at how many high-level players have had anterior dislocations on that lead shoulder. You know, I think the ones that are particularly challenging are the one-arm finishes. You got a guy who's a two-arm finish, you know, they tend to distribute force a lot better. It's kind of like if you look at tennis elbow, right? You very rarely see tennis elbow in someone who hits a two-handed backhand. See it all the time in one-handed backhands because they're, you know, you're effectively doubling the forces. So, you know, in that capacity, we spent a lot of time working really, really hard with making sure that lead shoulder and hitters is good, but also optimizing the amount of motion they get through their thoracic spine so that, you know, it's kind of like pulling the parking brake when you're driving 100 miles an hour. You'd rather be 100 feet away than 60 feet away from the wall when it happens.
Folks, we got about 8 minutes left, just so you know. If you got any questions, type them up. We'll get them to Eric. If we miss, you know, I could also email them to Eric and then have them answer and email them back to you. Be glad that we're trying to help you as best we can. You know, Eric, here's a – I guess this is a debate, whatever you want to call it, from an expert standpoint. We talk about there's many ways to increase velocity. One of them, obviously, part of the program is weighted balls. Yeah. The ages, the size of the player, the strength, the flexibility, when does a player start to use these type of things? Because, you know, we're seeing a lot of young kids using this stuff at 11, and we're not even sure if they're strong enough to handle it. Their bio, you know, movements and patterns are good enough. Can you add some, a lot to that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm not inherently against weighted balls. We use them a lot. I just think they have to be used in the right people at the right time in the right volume. I think historically what we've probably seen on the weighted ball side of things is it's a sexy training implement. So people want to get to use it right away, even though they kind of haven't done the foundational stuff to necessarily earn it. You know, I think the first point is that you make your money with a 5 ounce baseball. That's the one that matters the most. So if you haven't learned how to hold a four seam correctly, you haven't learned how to like actually impart force to a baseball correctly, that's something that you need to work on because you're not going to develop that with a weighted baseball, particularly when a lot of them don't even have seams on them. So that's priority number one. The other thing I would tell you is for me, there's a need for a general foundation of strength, right? So if throwing a 5 ounce baseball is over here, this is, you know, the absolute speed end of the continuum. Over here, we've got, you know, strength training. That's going to be the absolute strength end of the continuum. We need to bring athletes all the way over to the strength side of things for them to be in the best position for long-term development. And then eventually, once they develop that foundational strength, then you can start looking for a lot more of the exciting stuff in the middle, whether that's, you know, throwing med balls, whether it's, you know, throwing weighted balls, whatever it may be. You know, with that said, I do know that there's a school of thought that basically says that, you know, there are times when you can use a weighted ball to clean up an arm action. And we've certainly seen that. We've seen guys put a weighted ball on their glove side and it can make a big difference in their delivery. Yep. We also know footballs are inherently heavier than baseballs. And we very rarely see football quarterbacks with you know, Tommy John surgery and stuff along those lines. So I think what it all comes back to is you have to vilify the application and not the method, right? Mm. So weighted balls aren't inherently evil, just like yoga isn't inherently evil, barbells aren't inherently evil, you know, anything is inherently evil, but used incorrectly with the wrong person at the wrong time, they can be problems. So it just comes back to good assessments and you know, well thought out programming.
Excellent. And Alejandro Borges asks, from an international standpoint, how important are the winter leagues now? And, you know, to get players, their ABs, their innings pitched, maybe add that. Are some of your, any of your players in those leagues?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly going to be, I've already heard guys just talking about it at the facility, you know, as something they're considering. We had a player who threw really, really well in Puerto Rico last year, and he's already gotten an invite to go back. He was a free agent, so he doesn't have a team right now. So, you know, that's something for him that's a, you know, a matter of livelihood. I think, yeah, you are going to see guys that go there to get, you know, make up for lost time with respect to at-bats and innings. I think the biggest question is whether it's going to be safe. You know, I think that's what comes back on everything is nobody's going to commit to anything until we kind of have a little better feel for how the world is shaping up. Like right now, obviously we're seeing like South America has become a pretty crazy hotbed for coronavirus. You know, they were a little bit, you know, late. I know the Nicaraguan Baseball League was just shut down because they had an outbreak.
I saw that.
And so we don't really know what's going to happen. You know, I've heard of colleges who have changed their academic calendars around, concerned about a second wave of this. So I think we're, you know, it's hard to say too much about anything right now because it is such a, an unprecedented time, but you know, I can certainly see winter leagues, you know, thriving and having more talent than they've had in the past. If we have had a scenario where a lot of really good players have missed out on a lot, if not all, of their seasons.
Absolutely. And finally, you know, I love that you use the word a lot, you know, long-term development. I think we need to keep that in mind, especially at the younger ages. It's a long-term, it's not that short sprint. Finally, you know, to all the coaches out there that are working with all these kids, they're all going in a certain direction, just to kind of keep them on the right path. Last minute advice to help them out, you know, because sometimes we may be going in this direction, we have to be going in that one.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the biggest thing above all else, I'll give you the best example I possibly can. I got a really nice email from the father of a 15-year-old kid. This is probably back in 2008. It was after his first off season with us, you know, basically a kid had put on 20 pounds, changed his life. And I got a really nice email from the father saying that, you know what, this is also a big deal because he made some tough decisions. He committed to your program. And in doing so, he got away from some friends who were making some bad decisions, that were drinking, you know, they were dipping, they were getting into drugs, whatever it may be. And, you know, your facility became a sanctuary for him, you know, and I remember the email was distinctly, you know, it was, you know, finished up with a paragraph, I believe with your help, he can achieve his dream of playing, you know, college baseball at some point. And, you know, fast forward 2 years, we had his draft party at my house. It was Tyler Beede. He got taken 21st overall in the major league draft, turned down a bunch of money, went to Vanderbilt, won a national championship. And then was a first rounder again by the Giants. He's a big leaguer. So the lesson there is you don't know who your Tyler Beede is going to be. You know, we'd love to say that every kid we interact with is going to be a first rounder, but to me, you know, you have to treat everybody well. You have to pretend like every one of them is going to be a big leaguer, and you have to give them that attention to detail, and you have to care about them on a personal level, because it's a big deal for parents to invest in you, when their kids are at a time that's very impressionable and, you know, they're looking for role models for their sons and daughters. So, we don't take that responsibility lightly. And, you know, I'm sure that a lot of the people listening to this call are in the exact same boat, because you wouldn't be devoting your time to listen to me talk if you weren't passionate about getting better. So I'll just tell you, it's about them. It's not about us. And every time I bring myself back to reconsider that, I feel like it's always a good grounding force in my career.
Absolutely. Well said. Love it. And, you know, on a funny note, I remember these kids, if they get to the big leagues and you didn't treat them well, they're going to remember that. You're not going to get any tickets either. I just wanted to kid around a little bit. But, hey, listen, man, again, folks, we're going to get you Eric's information. So, you know, I got guys and gals in the U.S. and around all over the world listening. Want to get your information also in case they want to reach out to you, ask some questions. And again, I told everybody, you know, Eric didn't know me. He jumped on. He just loves helping baseball people. Obviously, deals in a lot of sports. So, Eric, man, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate everybody joining as well.
All right. Stay safe. And thank you, everybody. Thanks for joining us in the U.S. and around the world. Thank you for joining us on Twitter, Zoom, and on Facebook. Remember, this is the show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge of status quo. My biggest fans are the ones who listen to the show, and you guys and gals, I love you. I want to thank you for always joining us, for spreading the show. You're making it bigger and bigger as we keep going here. So keep doing it. Anytime I can be of help, let me know. Check out the show. It'll be live also on YouTube tonight. YouTube, Peter Caliendo, in case you missed the show. So again, this is Pete Caliendo in Chicago at our studios. I want to wish you the best. Stay safe. Get back on the field soon. We'll see you soon. And see you on tomorrow's show with Darren Fenster from the Boston Red Sox. Will be a great one. See you tomorrow.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.